Esther chapter 7. Where we left off is we are right in the middle of Queen Esther's plan to hopefully save her people from execution, save all the Jews, all the Israelites from execution that are in the in this kingdom, in King Ahasuerus or King Xerxes' kingdom here of Persia. And so we are just about to start the second banquet that she had planned. And her plan was to have two banquets. The first one was only to get the king and this wicked Haman here at a banquet, just to get them feeling good, but mainly it was just the king. But she had Haman come to both for this second occasion as this, but is to get the king in her good graces, and as a result, have an opportunity to request that he go back on this plan to execute all of the Jews in the entire kingdom. That we're going to find out in this next chapter, in chapter 8, that that's not possible to take away the decree because it was already written. So, but that is the plan. And so they've already had the first banquet and it went well. And unbeknownst to Queen Esther, God has now intervened through his providence, and the king did not have a restful night. In fact, he had a sleepless night, and through readings of the history of the Persians, then they the servants read to him about that Mordecai was actually a hero and had saved his life, which that happened in chapter 2. But the king had forgotten all about that, but it was brought back to his memory, and he said, well, has he been honored? And the servant said, no, he hadn't been honored at all. And so this wicked Haman came in right at that time, and that's when the king put into place Haman's plan of what Haman thought, how he should be honored himself is what he was thinking. And so the king said, okay, everything that you said to do, do it for Mordecai and honor him. And you lead the horse around and say that this is how the king honors someone. And so Haman is very humiliated. And so we end up, here he is, he goes back to his house after he has to walk around this horse all over town telling how basically how great this Mordecai is and how he's being honored by the king. And he's telling his friends and his wife how humiliated and all, which his wife tells him that he will not, that he will fall now before Mordecai. He will not be raised up above Mordecai now. He's about to come to a fall, which is exactly what's going to happen, because he will be dead in a matter of hours now. And I'm going to assume this is at lunchtime, and right after this, he's executed. So her words from his wife's words from verse 13 of chapter 6, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. So that's exactly what he ends up doing. And then I'll go ahead and read verse 14, because that sets the scene for chapter 7, verse 1. But while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Okay, so he's still mourning and feeling very humiliated, and that's when the eunuchs come and get him for this nice banquet that Esther has prepared for him and the king. So, chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. On the second day, at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you, and what is your request? Up to half the kingdom it shall be done." So he repeats the same thing that he's already asked her and a couple of times before. And so now she's going to give him the request, as she had promised that she would after the second banquet. So verse 3. Then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." So, she reveals in this, you would have, not verbatim, but you'd have to read between the lines, that she is a Jew. And that she is going to also be annihilated and killed through this order that the king had written. And so, before this, the king did not know that she was a Jew. But she also tells him that if they had been just sold as slaves, mere workers like the Israelites were for 400 years into Egyptian slavery, she said that she wouldn't have said anything, which is somewhat strange to me. But anyway, she wouldn't have opened her mouth. She'd have let all the Jews be sold into slavery, if that's what it was. But it was this annihilation, and ultimately taking out the messianic lineage that she couldn't stand for. So this is her chance on saving this. And then she makes this statement, "Although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." Now the enemy is about to be identified as the wicked Haman. But with her saying that Haman could never compensate for the king's loss, Kaufman's thought on this was that she was saying that he could never pay the king the 10,000 talents of silver that he had promised the king. And maybe that's what she was saying. Otherwise, I don't know. The only other thing that I could think of that wasn't brought up by any of the commentators was here, I don't know how many people, how many Jews there are, maybe upwards to a million in this kingdom, but maybe not, but surely several hundred thousand at this time of about 500 BC. That they are productive members of the kingdom, and maybe you could not replace what they were doing and contributing to the kingdom. And that's the only other thing that I can think of. So it's either this 10,000 talents, he's not going to pay you, or you could not replace all the work that these Jews are doing for you through the whole kingdom and how productive they are. So, but anyway, that's her statement, and this is her plea. And so now it's up to the king at this point. So verse 5. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" So, in here the king signed with his ring or gave it to Haman to be signed. And so this wicked decree went out, which almost makes me wonder if maybe he didn't know the exact wording on this decree, because he gave that ring to Haman and maybe he just didn't know what all was written on it. But he acts like he's completely oblivious that he has an order that is sent out through the whole kingdom to annihilate every Jewish person on this certain day at the end of the year. And so ultimately, he is just as much culpable as Haman is. But the king doesn't hold himself responsible, and no one does hold him accountable. Only Haman is the one that's going to get held accountable for this. And he was the one that brought it all up, and he was ultimately the one behind it. But verse 6, "And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So that's obviously why she wanted Haman to be coming to both of these, probably hoping that this very thing would happen and that they needed Haman right there in the midst of them. And so Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. So now he knows his life is on the line, and he just doesn't know what has happened. Here he started this morning so happy and had this what he thought was a very good plan. He was going to crucify or have his enemy Mordecai crucified that morning, and then he was going to come merrily to this banquet, and everything was going to go good. But everything went bad from the get-go, and I'm going to say this started probably before daylight, and everything has gone down with him, from having to honor Mordecai all over town to now he's about to get the death sentence, and he knows that his life is on the line. So verse 7, "Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden." So he leaves the banquet hall and he goes out into the garden, obviously to think about what he's going to do. "But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king." So he knew with the king walking out that he's about to get executed. So he thought, well, I need to now plead before Queen Esther and let her get her to change her mind about killing me. And then, in turn, convince the king not to kill me. So verse 8, "When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he also assault the queen while I am in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face." So this is a somewhat strange wording, how it at least gets translated into English. But what the commentators thought was going on here is that Haman was either holding on to her feet and pleading for his life, or maybe even had fallen over her legs while she was, because they eat in a reclining type position, and they think that that's what she's still in, is she hasn't gotten up from the table, or basically, I guess it says here a couch, but whatever she's sitting on, whatever they've been eating on, and she's still reclined. The king had gotten up and left, but she's still reclined, and so maybe she's fallen over his legs, over the queen's legs. And whatever it was, the position that he was in with Esther, when the king suddenly comes back into the banquet hall, he thinks that he's about to assault or kill Queen Esther right then and now, which he was not. He was pleading for his life. But from whatever he was doing, the king thought that he was assaulting Queen Esther right there, right in front of the king, and he couldn't believe it. And so then the king's servants came and covered Haman's face, which that's the wording. It was covered his head. And so it put a bag over his head, and all the commentators said that anyone that had their head covered in a bag, you had gotten the death sentence. So this is his faith. The king has spoken now that he's condemned to death. And this covering of the head is, we all know about that because our culture, at least in the past, did that for many years when someone was going to be hanged by the rope. Before they would hang, while they were up on the hanging gallows, they would have all the men's face covered, heads covered in a cloth or a bag, and then they'd put the rope around their necks. So this is very similar to the same thing that they did even then. So verse 9. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." So he'd been given the death sentence in verse 8. And now in verse 9, this is the method of his execution. He was going to be crucified, the very thing that he intended for Mordecai to have been done. And on the very tree that he intended to hang Mordecai on, he's going to get it. And his wife was so bloodthirsty, looking for a crucifixion and looking happily forward to it. Well, she's going to get to see it, but it's going to be her husband instead of who they perceived as their enemy, Mordecai. So verse 10, so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. So this was the end of Haman, but now we still have this decree that has gone out through the whole kingdom, and so now I guess this is the third part of the plan that Esther had, and it's now going to try to get the king to reverse this decree that he had sent out, but they're going to find out that this decree cannot be rescinded in any fashion or form, which we'd already known from the book of Daniel when we covered that. There were a couple of times they had decrees, and they can never go back on that. Once it's written, then it's written and it will be gone through. But the king comes up with a good alternative and an alternative way that the Jews can save themselves. And so that's what they put into play. But we will plan to go over that with chapter 8 next week.